Welcome to another edition of the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. Today's program features former FBI Special Agent Colleen Rowley. She's going to talk about the ethical failures which compel whistleblowers like Edward Snowden to risk their lives to tell the truth about what's going on. We will do our usual format today, which is we will hear from Ms. Rowley and then take a short break, and then we'll do the question and answer period. This program was recorded on Sunday, September the 14th at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. And let's have our introduction.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the All Souls UU Forum. I'm Carolyn McDonald, a long-term member of the Forum Committee. We have lots and lots of wonderful local talent, but there are certain times when we just really want to bring someone from outside, someone who doesn't live in Kansas City, and that's what we have done today. Now, Tom Clammer, who is known to many of us as someone who's on KKFI with the Tell Somebody show, has lots and lots of contacts and knows many, many people through his work on the radio show. And he is going to introduce our speaker this morning. So, Tom.
Thank you. And thank you, Carolyn. And I'd like to once again thank the All Souls for putting on this forum, making many wonderful speakers available. I hope you will all tell your friends about the All Souls Forum and support it in any way you can. And it is broadcast a couple of weeks later, generally, on KKFI, Wednesdays at noon. Tune in. Tell your friends about that, too. I think I could pretty easily talk about Colleen Rowley right up to Q&A time or beyond. I won't do that to you if you'll forgive me for leaving a lot out. One of the things that I think is relevant particularly today and means a lot to her is that she taught law and ethics to FBI and police officers prior to 9/11 in the Minneapolis FBI office. She got a law degree in Iowa and went to work for the FBI. She worked at different times in the Paris office, Montreal, New York City with organized crime, and in Minneapolis, and where she was chief division counsel. She testified before Congress about FBI failures related to 9/11. That's something else I could go right up to Q&A time about. But as a result of some of that, she was on the cover of Time magazine in 2002, along with a couple of corporate whistleblowers, as co-person of the year. She was one of the four people who went to Moscow last fall to present a Sam Adams Award for truth-telling to Edward Snowden. Probably millions of people that never heard of her saw her on television clips that looped over and over again on the mainstream media. So I guess with no further ado, I bring you former FBI agent Colleen Rowley.
Thanks so much. It is a real honor to be speaking at a forum that I've learned has 73 years of history and has all of these, you know, varied speakers that have told the truth for all these years on very important topics. Right now, I think this topic of ethics, following ethical decision-making, which involves following the law, people kind of put them in separate categories, but to be honest, the law comes about as a result of some of these long ingrained ethical principles that are shown to work, to actually be pragmatic, things like due process. You know, due process, somebody just didn't legislate and write a law saying we're going to have due process. This came about through 800 years of experience in how to find, how to detect guilty people that have committed a wrongdoing and how to eventually prove that they were the perpetrator, etc. So we have a long process of understanding that this is what works. It's something that's wise and works more times than not. Well, we get to, traumatic events, things like 9/11 that are traumatic, that are used and exploited to press people's emotional buttons. People all around the world are vulnerable to five terrible emotions. And these are fear, hate, greed, false pride, and blind loyalty. And when you press those buttons on almost everyone, you can manipulate large populations of people to do very wrong things. And you can even get them to forget about all of the universal ethical principles that have guided civilizations for hundreds of years. And that's why I think we find ourselves in what a judge recently called a nearly Orwellian society, where telling the truth becomes an act, where universal deceit is so bad that telling the truth becomes a revolutionary act. That's the story of Edward Snowden. All he's doing is showing these documents that the truth is our own government is spying on American citizens. I mean, no one, even the people who are defending this, can't deny that. But that's now become so revolutionary that the majority of the American population, again, through this manipulation of their emotional vulnerabilities, high percentage, I think they phrase it in different questions, but a majority think Edward Snowden is a traitor. Just as they thought, by the way, during Vietnam that Daniel Ellsberg was this terrible traitor. And they were this close to prosecuting Jane Fonda for going to North Vietnam, etc. So you find that in these environments, it becomes extremely challenging. This is a cartoon. Does anyone know Ted Rall, the cartoonist? He wrote this cartoon in 2011. And it's kind of a funny thing because you got your NSA spying on a bedroom. And they have it all profiled out, who the woman is, who the man is. It turns out Ted Rall was very prescient. This was before Edward Snowden's disclosures. And he actually has it about right. This is about what's going on. You know, in terms of a TV screen, maybe not, except for the really targeted folks who are being webcammed. But the truth is, through profiling and collecting what one whistleblower says is 20 trillion now vacuumed up pieces of data on innocent people. People that they have no threshold of evidence at all to believe are terrorists. You would never know that from listening to George Bush and Obama, both of them, who claim that this is a way to target terrorists. No, this is actually what they call, even the NSA called, collect it all. And through, by doing so, they have systems that they can profile, because everything that you, your locations, your emails, everything like this, and then they graph it out into your, all of the people you know, all of the people who know the people you know, and then the third one, all of the people who know the people who know the people. And it comes to be millions of people that are connected to you. As, you know, Stanley Milgram, the famous, we're all connected. It's true we're all connected. We are all connected, actually, if you graph it out that way, to terrorists. That's just the way it is. You've walked, probably in your way that you've walked right by somebody who committed a criminal act. That's just the way we interact. But this is of no relevance. It's of zero relevance to being able to conduct a... So let's go back to the basics. Some of my PowerPoint I was able to put together by the FBI's own ethics presentation that was given 1 week before 9/11. I'm not going to go into it. It was a long story that the FBI ordered all 56 field offices to give this presentation on law enforcement ethics 1 week before 9/11. And I was the ethics person, law and ethics, and we had two kinds of ethics in the FBI. But this was the basic one, and this was actually one of the slides. And what it is it shows that the ethical line is you cut yourself a margin so that you're operating above the criminal line. People who are really ethical do that for a reason, because they don't want to even come close to the criminal line. So they cut themselves a little slack and they operate above, and it's self-policing. So you're not going to do these things, and it's not because the police will catch you. The other line, of course, is unfortunately what has happened for a lot of different reasons, greed being a major factor. But people operate, especially the profit makers, operate right on the criminal line, because this is where profits are greatest. And they actually, if they feel they will not get caught, if they think they're whatever, or if the fine they pay is so small, minuscule compared to the money they make. Even Elliot Spitzer, now the very first go-around of fraud where Elliot Spitzer was the New York Attorney General and whatever, before that he became the New York Attorney General. By the way, he was in the same Time magazine. We three whistleblowers were on the cover, but that's the year Elliot Spitzer should have won, 2002, because he had gone against all of this fraud. And he gave interviews and he said, well, what could I do? The fine they paid was $40,000, but they made $15 million. Well, anybody can do the math. If the fine is $40,000 and you made $15 million, everyone, including probably almost all of us, will be going below the line. You got Lance Armstrong. I'll just recommend a quick book here if you've never read it called The Cheating Culture. And this book now details all of these ethical lapses that have been magnified because the incentives are just so great to. This is another slide that was in our FBI PowerPoint, and this slide is about do not puff, shade, tailor, firm up, stretch, massage, or tidy up statements of fact. Of course, everybody might know the history of the FBI. There's been some challenges with that statement. And lots of them. I'd be up here for another 3 hours. But this was an admonition that was given to all of FBI agents. And, I always ask audiences, what would be the three-letter word that would sum up puff, shade, tailor, firm up, stretch, but would be a harsher term? And even young people say, lie, do not lie. I mean, young people yell, do not lie. Now, if you tell people they're lying, that will turn them off right at the start. So if you give this thing to tell the FBI not to lie, people will immediately, go against the speaker. So they actually made it nicer sounding by these other basically equivalent verbs to lie. Do not lie. And this other one is really important when it comes to whistleblowing, misplaced loyalties. I'll talk about it in a little bit more. But there are different tiers of loyalties. And so this all gets blurred and confused. Many ethical books themselves begin with what is called a true ethical dilemma, so that you're pitting the loyalty to your family against the loyalty to a larger good or a larger, a bigger, and usually vaguer concept. A great example is the Unabomber's brother, Ted Kaczynski's brother, is the only one after 18 years who figured out that a guy sending mail bombs through the mail was his own brother, his only brother. And so his wife figured it out first, told her husband, and then this poor guy was faced with this ethical dilemma of, do I go tell the FBI that the Unabomber, they weren't even at square one. They had an artist depiction that didn't even look like him, and they were offering $1 million. And again, this went on for 18 years. So don't put a lot of stock into our great prevention, this idea of preventing crime and stuff. It's not true. That's just fiction. And the truth is, if this brother had not gone, the only thing he decided that he had to put the victims, even unknown victims that he had no connection to, future victims, above his loyalty to his own family. And that's what he did. And you will see some rare examples of that. The more common is not. People are going to go with their closer loyalties. And they're going to say, oh, my loyalty to my family. Fugitives, parents hide fugitives, and they're always going to say, what could I do? It's my son. Whatever. So in this case, I'll get to it, but the highest loyalty in serving a government or the U.S. government is not the persons, not the president. Condi Rice slipped up once and said, basically implied the president, just like Nixon, gets to make the law, and her loyalty was to the president. We had Monica Goodling on the stand when she was being questioned about how the Department of Justice had developed a litmus test wrong. She goes, well, I have to do what the president ordered. So you get many, many people in government, even at the highest levels, believing that their loyalty is to the person. But in fact, everybody who joins government, military across, swears their oath to uphold and defend the Constitution. And this is the thing with whistleblowing. I'm in debates all the time. I'm going to be in another one with a military guy. And they cannot understand that. They think that your secrecy oath is a personal loyalty and that this Constitution, if you know of unconstitutional actions, you keep your mouth shut because your loyalty is to the person. J. Edgar Hoover, if we have time, ask me about J. Edgar Hoover's concept of loyalty. This is still another one. This is my own frame, this is my own depiction of this, but, you know, everybody knows right and wrong, you know, clear right and wrong, but then everybody makes this gray area. Our lawyers, beginning after 9/11 and continuing until now, the lawyers in the administration are what I call pettifoggers, shysters. They will take a word like in the Patriot Act, the idea that you can get third-party records. Of course, it allows for that. But it was to be on an investigation, a case. Well, they reinterpreted that notion that it had to be at least targeted on a case. Okay, so if you had a suspect, yes, you can get their telephone records, easily get their records with a subpoena. Does not require probable cause. But they took that and they said, the whole world is a case. Everyone out there, including American citizens, are considered suspects, potential suspects. And if we are to prevent, of course they can't do this, they don't tell you the truth, but if we are to prevent the next terrorist act, we have to gather all of this information. Then we had the other case of torture. Everybody well knows the memo written August 1st, redefined torture. And so all these years later, we're maybe a week or two from having a torture report come out by our Senate Intelligence Committee. But up until now, the media, our own mainstream media, could not use the word torture. They had to change it to enhanced interrogation tactics. They just now, the New York Times, about a week or two ago, made a decision that because the torture report was coming out, that they would finally call it by its true name, torture. That's incredible. All these years that we've been lied to, essentially, even by our own media, because they said torture wasn't torture. It was just organ damage, as long as you didn't kill the person, etc. That was John Yoo's August 1st, 2002 memo. The other really egregious lie that we're witnessing now is war. When they were bombing Libya, there's a law, there's a constitution that says a president cannot start a war without congressional authorization. There's one loophole that if it's an emergency, they can start it, but then 60 days later, the War Act, they have to go in and explain it, and then Congress has to authorize it. Well, different lawyers in the Obama administration, I think Carol Koh was one of the main ones, dean of the Yale Law School, writes up an opinion that you can not call it a war. So if you're just merely bombing these other people, yes, they'll be dying, but as long as American casualties are kept low, we don't have to call it a war. And that's what's going on to this day, where Obama is saying that he does not need congressional authorization to re-begin the war on Iraq, as well as start a new war on Syria. Okay, so it can be argued. That's a great lawyer phrase.
Now, this is kind of this again comes from the FBI PowerPoint I gave, the same ethics training that the FBI was getting. Discernment, that's like figuring out yourself what is the truth. Mark Twain has a famous quote that rarely gets answered. His quote was, "Why is it that moral courage is so rare while other kinds, physical courage, is relatively common?" And we all know firemen rush into burning buildings, risking their own lives for people they don't know, putting their biggest loyalties. The famous scene from The Perfect Storm where the Coast Guard are flying in a helicopter. They look down on the stupid people on this boat that's in a who disregarded Coast Guard warnings to sail into the perfect storm. And they're clinging to the front, and instead of saying, "Why in the heck would we risk our lives for these people that, you know, did wrong acts themselves?" they strap on their things and they drop into a 20-foot wave. Famous scene from Perfect Storm. I got to speak at the Coast Guard Academy, and I got applause for that line. Why is that? Well, I have an answer. One is that the people who practice for dangerous, self-risking activities, number one, they practice. They're not like my fellow Time Person of the Year, Sharon Watkins, who found herself in Enron and never would have realized that the whole hierarchy of Enron was lying to their stockholders, lying to the public. I mean, she finds herself, "Oh, my gosh, this isn't true. We don't have these profits. It's not true." And so she goes into Kenneth Lay thinking that the boss, her boss's boss's boss, will correct it. She has no idea that Kenneth Lay is in on the plot. And she goes in and tells him and lays this out for him. So when you're in those situations, you have never practiced being in a situation like that. You honestly believe that people are doing the right things. Number two, the people who sign up to do risky things have actually they've thought about these issues beforehand because they signed on dotted lines that I will, like a fireman, I mean, I know that I'm going to be risking my life in some cases like this. And then they try to be careful. But still, this is the difference. You also, one other difference is moral courage. It tends to be more individual than these other kinds of courage, which are group bonding things. Our military, of course, likes to say that they're courageous and they're heroes and all the rest, but they train so that they're really fighting for the other people in their group, not really fighting for some principle of freedom. I mean, this idea of fighting for freedom, you can use it as a justification, but the truth is when you're in these war situations, you are actually fighting for your own lives and the lives of the people that you've bonded with. So it's a group affair. Whereas what Edward Snowden did and what many of the whistleblowers I know is absolutely going against the group. And that is so difficult. That is exactly why people have a tough time, because of loyalties. Last thing is it has to be constructive and open, et cetera. It's the how do you do this. And, of course, I'll answer this question later if we have time, but Snowden is always accused of not being constructive because he went to the media, to the public. But what people don't know is that the prior NSA whistleblowers, very similarly to Daniel Ellsberg, who thought if he could get the information to the congressional oversight boards at the time about the Pentagon Papers, he thought if he could get the senators, and they looked at it, they promised they'd get it out, nothing. So in the NSA, there were two inspector general investigations of this, all secret, of course, mostly secret. The fraud involved is immense. These were the first NSA whistleblowers who were well-respected. Bill Binney, 30-some years in the NSA. He was one of their top mathematicians and analysts, code breakers. He was the first whistleblower, and he went to IGs, he went to Congress, and he himself then was retaliated against. All of them were Thomas Drake, and so there were at least four or five of these, and they were actually had guns put to their heads. These were our own insider NSA. So, of course, Snowden realized, "I have no chance of doing it going internally. I'm going to have to go outside the system. And that, at that point, is the most constructive. We have a First Amendment, freedom of press, because the founding fathers recognized that this would be, in some cases, the only way of deterring abuses of power. They recognize this. That's why we have freedom of press. What's gone on in this nearly Orwellian thing is now they are threatening to put reporters and treating them just as they would the leakers. We've had affidavits that claim that the AP and Fox, and there's been, and New York Times, Pulitzer Prize winning reporter James Risen of the New York Times, can be prosecuted themselves under these old 1917 espionage acts. Risen tried to fight it up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court refused. And now, I can talk more about this, but I think he is facing being jailed. A Pulitzer Prize winning New York Times writer is facing jail for not giving up his source. And, of course, what's the worst part about this is all the reporters know this. And there is very little choice for them now. They can abandon the First Amendment. A lot of them have. A lot of them have said, well, okay, I'll just publish the government transcripts, and I'm not going to worry about investigating the truth of these things because I can't. I mean, the majority probably go that route. The ones who are still trying are trying to develop encryption and different ways of, you know, something like WikiLeaks ways. Daniel Ellsberg actually now has a Freedom of the Press group himself that is trying to develop ways that the government cannot spy on reporters and cannot learn about getting the truth out. I'm going to have to speed up, but this, you might remember, all of our social psychologists have proven how human psychology works in group dynamics. The A, B, and C clearly are, this was his lying test in 51. You can see they're all different lengths, and I'm going to tell you the answer since we don't have time. X is exactly, if you measure these, X is exactly the same as A, the longest line. When you give this test to people, they will pick A. If they're just using their naked eyesight, they will largely be correct. Unless they have problems with their eyesight, they will be correct in picking A to match X. But when he gave the test, he brought in groups of three people, and by prior agreement, the first two were his confederates, and they picked the shortest line, B, to match X. When you are the third person in this little group, 66% of the time, two-thirds of the time, the third person does not want to be seen as going against the other two and does not even trust their own eyesight and goes along with the others. This was Esch's student was Milgram. He did the electric voltage test and found about the same thing. Two-thirds of the time, a person who is trying to be obedient to authority will give an electric shock that would kill somebody else. And these are all good people. So it's really frightening to know about human nature because it shows how easy and how vulnerable people are. This goes back to my conflicting loyalties. You know, if you look at them as Venn diagrams, this is kind of the hierarchy of loyalties. One really well-renowned ethicist, Cecilia Bach, has anyone read her books? If you're into ethics, Bach is one of the top. And she says all ethics comes down to competing and conflicting loyalties. And I would have to agree. Now, where you should be operating are these largest loyalties. And, of course, I'm looking at some signs coming in here. I think Unitarians kind of get this to some extent, you know, with the bicycle out there, that this loyalty to the earth. Okay, most people have a really difficult time. We're going to start mutual assured destruction with Russia. They have a really difficult time of seeing that their highest loyalty should be to the earth and to the human species as a whole instead of to my country. We're going to threaten nuclear war, etc. So the highest loyalty should be the broadest, most general ones instead of the more narrow ones. And these come into conflict. Okay, they don't always come into conflict because many times helping yourself helps your family, helps your workplace, helps your country, and helps the larger one. So they don't come into conflict, but when they do, then you get these ethical dilemmas. Okay, this is the also very well, this little cartoon by Ben Sargent, who gave me permission, by the way, to use his cartoon, shows all of your myriad of top secret America groups. There are now close to 2,000. This is just burgeoned. If you read the Washington Post, Top Secret America, the whole industry after 9/11, because preying on people's fears and this false idea that we could prevent a terrorist attack. Okay, so they just gave a blank check to the NSA and they created all of these private contractors. Thousands of private contractors. Well, I should say not thousands, but hundreds. There's at least 1,200 are private profit-making contractors now that are part of this new national security surveillance industrial complex. That's a little brother to the military industrial complex. So you see all the acronyms. I love the SNAFU in there. They all should be named SNAFU. But there's all laugh out loud. You know, they have funny. So when they're looking at this complicated chart, the overweight bureaucrat says to the other one, well, who actually catches the terrorists? And the other one says, usually it's an alert T-shirt vendor. And that's not funny because it's true. It's true. It's like a lot of sarcasm. The truth is actually, and we laugh about it because we know it's true. In Times Square, the car that was smoking that would have blown up Times Square was caught by street vendors. Not the NSA with all of its massive collection or the FBI. Abdulmutallab on the underwear bomber was stopped by fellow passengers. So was Richard Reed. Okay, there's a whole series of people that it's almost always the public, and that's why they say keep alert, whatever, but it's got to be the public. There's no way that these other systems can do it. In fact, it's the opposite. It's a haystack of collecting irrelevant data that then makes it more difficult to really detect the relevant data. It's a haystack. I was one of the first people to call to use this metaphor about how does it help to find a needle in a haystack. And actually, I know of a case in Minnesota where it was, you know, they found a terrorist before 9/11 in August of 2001. There was one of the 9/11 suspects was operating, learning to fly in Minnesota. They found him in August. And so I know that it was very possible, and it actually happens. You can find this. But now, with trillions of pieces of non-relevant data, it makes it more difficult, just as adding hay to a haystack. Well, when people started, repeating this, that this was at like a haystack, this last summer, when the government agencies were fighting reform of the NSA, they came up with a new way of turning this around, and they said, if we want to find a terrorist, we have to create a haystack. Okay, so they've just turned that around. They mean we need all these trillions of info. And, of course, what happens, you know, I said non-relevant data. This poor lady who was against fracking in Pennsylvania, it actually occurred that they were the anti-fracking group was being spied on. We have all kinds of cases of anti-war people who have been investigated, different groups, but environmentalists, I mean, a whole series of groups that are even some people that are trying to think, they mentioned Ron Paul group once. So it's getting to be more and more where they say that they have to investigate other groups. And they'll find all different things to be suspicious about. You know, in this case, I don't know if you can see it, but it says her skirt might be burqa length. You know, so, and what is she hiding in her bun? Could it be a bomb? This is not too far from the truth, and this is what happened, frankly, under the COINTELPRO era with J. Edgar Hoover, is that, you know, he had he had a list of enemies, but eventually, in a wartime especially, all of the people who are opposing war, the Jane Fondas, it's so bad that they actually then begin to target senators. The NSA's Minaret program that to this day is secret, that occurred during the last part of Vietnam and beginning of the 70s, we only have one document that has been declassified, And this one declassified document on the NSA's Minaret program at the end of Vietnam listed 7 Americans who were on a list of 1,500 Americans. We don't know the other 1,400 and some, but we know 7. They were Art Buchwald for being too humorous and being too whatever. They were Muhammad Ali, Martin Luther King, of course, everyone would know. The other two here, a New York Times editor was on the list. The most scary thing is the two that there are known to be on the list, Frank Church, Senator Frank Church, and Howard Baker. So this is what people have to understand is when you unleash these dogs and you say no laws apply to us anymore, you are actually dooming yourself. I've called a number of senators on NSA reform, and I say, don't you realize this isn't on them? It's on us and you. This could be on you, just as Frank Church himself was targeted. And that should make them think a little bit more, because if they think it's on other people, they don't think as much. I'm going to have to end here real quick because I want to save a lot of time for questions, and I'll just leave this up. This is where whistleblowing, by the way, is not to be undertaken lightly. It's right now it's life and death. There's the indictments against Snowden, which is to put him away, and it carries the death penalty. Espionage Act carries the death penalty. If you know the story of Daniel Ellsberg, he was to have been put in jail, I think, for 70 years until he was in his late 70s. He was facing Manning. Chelsea Manning now, she's in there for 35 years. So telling the truth about things that people don't want the truth to come out about is really dangerous. But so I have suggested these as guidelines. It has to be real significant, not just almost life and death. People could even argue that if it's just fraud, just taxpayers' money being wasted and pocketed, maybe that isn't even enough to blow the whistle on. Maybe it has to be actual life and death. The key thing is you can't be personally motivated for yourself. Anybody who's standing up and their complaint is actually dealing with themselves, I think, is going to rightly fall under suspicion that they're not actually passing this test. But unfortunately, our courts now have said your motivation doesn't matter. They will not allow, they did not allow Manning to show that he was trying to, uphold the Constitution and prevent criminal acts or stop criminal acts. They didn't even allow him to say this or put on evidence of this. So that's why, because it's very important. And that's my last little, how do they end truth-telling? Is easy. They just marginalize the truth-tellers, call them names. It's a little bit like Goring's. You just call the pacifists the enemy. You call the truth-tellers snitches. I say this was tattletale. And by the way, this is a funny, I got the permission from this cartoonist as well, because he's got Time magazine. So there was this glowing moment in 2002 where whistleblowing and truth-telling was actually honored. And that's really, of course, now historical. And I keep using it because I think it's important. But I'll leave that up, and I'm going to cease and desist, as they say. And I would welcome anyone. I brought an article that I wrote for CNN about the NSA spying, along with me, a few articles. So if people want to stick around afterwards, if they don't get their question asked, I'll be around in the room on the side over here. I forget what room.
Thank you very much.
We're listening to Colleen Rowley, former FBI agent from the Minneapolis FBI office, who at one time testified before Congress about the FBI's failure in the 9/11 attacks. She was named Time Person of the Year in 2002, by the way. We owe you a couple messages. You're listening to the All Souls Forum. Let's take a short break. We'll be back with the questions and answers for Ms. Rowley.
Your community radio station, KKFI, is a voter registration location, 3901 Main Street. And if you aren't registered, reside in Kansas City, Jackson County, we are targeting you to call 816-931-3000. 3122 to set up an appointment to get registered. October the 8th is the deadline. This has been a public service announcement by your community radio station, KKFI 90.1 FM.
Due to the generosity of local orthodontists in the Greater Kansas City area, Smiles Change Lives has openings left in 2014 for kids needing braces who qualify for the program. This is unusual, and we don't want any spots to go unfilled. Parents with children 10 to 18 in need of braces should go to smileschangelives.org/apply. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
A doctor and her infamous patient strike a deal for life and death over the operating table.
I want you to help me kill my son.
Going to St. Ives by Lee Blessing, starring Caroline Goodall and L. Scott Caldwell, next time on LA Theater Works.
Wednesday evening at 7, after ArtSpeak Radio. After the Harvest needs volunteers to pick fresh vegetables and fruit in the Greater KC area now. All ages are welcome. Please call 816-853-4460 or go to our Facebook page at After the Harvest KC for more information. This message, a public service of 90.1 KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
This week on the Heartland Labor Forum, have you been denied unemployment? Help is on the way. UMKC has a clinic to help people appeal the denial of claims. Also, the movement of fast food workers in Kansas City and across the country is growing, and it's intensifying its tactics. What has it achieved so far, and what's the game plan for the future? All that Thursday at 6 p.m. on the Heartland Labor Forum, rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
If your unemployment benefits have been denied in the last 30 days, you may be eligible for free legal assistance from attorneys and law students through the UMKC School of Law Unemployment Benefits Clinic. To find out if you are eligible for these free legal services, your unemployment benefits must have been denied in the last 30 days. Contact the clinic today and talk to an attorney about your case free of charge. Call 816-235-5129. Again, call 816-235-5129.
The hard part is just standing up. I just wanted to say, way to go, Colleen. We are all very much indebted to you for what you did and what you continue to do, and we appreciate your coming here. That was my speech. But I have a question that's a little bit, it has to do with the FBI, but it's not in the areas that you commented on. I've heard recently, in the last few months, a lot about the number of people, I can't remember the number, of people who have been killed, mostly shot to death by the FBI, and the fact that there has never been an outside investigation of any of these killings, and that there has never been an internal investigation by the FBI where they found that the shooter or the killer was in the wrong, mm-hmm. which is almost miraculous that it could turn out that way.
Yeah.
And I just wondered if you could comment on that sort
sure.
of tangential.
I'm going to just preface by saying I was one of the people who warned that starting the war on Iraq, I actually wrote a memo in opposition to this saying it would prove counterproductive. And I threw a lot of arguments in there, and I actually used the argument of Waco, and that this idea of charging the people at Waco turned out to be a complete mistake, and that's what we were doing in Iraq. I predicted that the war on others, this militarization, would blow back and migrate back home into law enforcement. And one of the reasons for that is the deadly force policies are different in war, very much looser. If you're on a war zone, you're entitled, you know, it got to be so bad. Now, this is not allowed. It's not supposed to be allowed. But there's been books written called Kill Everyone in the whatever. Nick Turse's book, does somebody remember the title? In Vietnam, it's Kill. That's exactly. The title of Nick Turse's book in Vietnam is Kill Anything That Moves. So that's what it can degrade to. Now, they would never say that. They'll say it's, you know, on the front, you're allowed to think anyone in a uniform is the enemy and you can shoot. Very different in law enforcement. In law enforcement, the deadly force policy that I taught agents is that your own life has to, there has to be the key word, imminent threat to your own life and or the life of an innocent person. And yes, then you're allowed to use deadly force in complete self-defense standard. That's what it's supposed to be. To my knowledge, now, FBI isn't the only one. You see all the police departments and they're all wearing full military gear. They're getting the tanks. Everyone knows since Ferguson, they're getting surplus. I mean, we're changing our own law enforcement who are supposed to be like Andy Griffith of Mayberry. They're supposed to be serving the public and doing common sense, you know, smart but humanitarian law enforcement. They called it community policing. That's what it's supposed to be. It's now changed almost into a war. So FBI has been part of that, I'm sure. And I will tell you also that many of the new agents hired after 9/11 were not the diversified backgrounds, but were more military. That's what they geared towards. Everybody's allowed this to happen. The oversight, I will say, is right. If any group can self-police, and they're the judges. The FBI always insisted that any internal complaint, they would adjudicate themselves secretly. And so, yes, you had people even, in 1994, we even had an FBI agent who murdered his own informant after he got her pregnant and drove her around in his trunk 3 days. Mark Putnam, he ended up doing a very small sentence for an outright deliberate murder. So that ended, supposedly ended around 2000, that they did not allow the FBI on other types of internal but serious internal wrongdoing to be investigating itself. We also had the FBI lab where they were doing, you know, fudging the data for prosecutors, and this was found out about the same time. Now, I think after 9/11, I think a lot of these good initiatives that there would be oversight have gone the other way. There is an inspector general in the Department of Justice that is supposed to be independent and in a way a little bit more independent than other IGs, because the other inspector generals work right under like the CIA director. So if you're a CIA inspector general and you're supposed to be investigating torture, but you're, you know, under the George Tenet, how much can you do? And usually the inspector general, if they do try, or like a General Taguba, three-star general, if they do try to find fact-finding on the highest levels, they're the ones who are going to be let go and released. They're not going to, you know, be able to do that. So this is very much your spot on in your comments, and we need more independent oversight, and that would, every time there has been independent oversight, it has worked to some extent. Don't be hopeless. Even the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, that came about in law in 2004. And people, some liberals said, oh, well, what good will that do, another board? To be honest, it took 10 years. They fought it tooth and nail to get started. 2004, it just got going, effectively going this year. It took 10 years from Congress saying we need a Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board. Truth is, they actually more or less agreed with Edward Snowden's findings that this was wrong and illegal, their very first work they did. So, I mean, we can't be hopeless, but yes, absolutely, self-policing of a big organization. Just ask the priesthood if this works, self-policing when it's all secret. Secrecy is the problem. It needs to be open. Okay, next question.
Got a... Have you written any books about this subject, and do you have anything that you've written about your career, your experiences working with the FBI?
You know, I've given lots of interviews, and the Time magazine article itself, which is really long, it features the stories of Sharon Watkins, the Enron whistleblower, Cynthia Cooper, the auditor of WorldCom, and me. So that story in there is mostly correct, with the exception of a couple of minor details. Somebody got a little carried away and said I was one of the best marksmen or something like that in my new agent class. I think I said I was so happy I did well on the final test. I said something like that because I surprised myself, you had to get 80-some percent or 85% to pass. Otherwise, you were, you know, they would send you home in your final test of shooting at the FBI. And I surprised myself, and I hit a lot of the target, but I certainly was not the best in my class. So there are couple of little tiny things like that in the article, but mostly that if you look up 2002 Time Magazine, it's still online, by the way. You can read it. And I will just mention one more thing about that Time Magazine. You know how Time says that they're going through this process of selecting its person of the year and that they take all this input. And they have five ideas, and then they don't tell the people that they're interviewing if you are going to be the Time person of the year. In the case of 2002, Bush and Cheney were selected to be the covers. And the reason you know or can easily surmise that they were selected, not us, not the whistleblowers, not Elliot Spitzer, to be the Time Person of the Year when they were doing it, is Time commissioned an oil painting of Bush and Cheney. And it's actually, when you open up that 2002 Time magazine, it's a pullout that's got this big oil painting, and they're going like this, you know, looking off like these great heroes. And that article, again, I would suggest everyone to read it. That article about Bush and Cheney painting them as the, you know, heroes, they take into consideration all facts, and oh my gosh, the things that they said in this were completely off base. But by just a fluke, I think, a couple of flukes, we were put on the cover and we were selected. So I have written 3 chapters in books. And every time I've written, beginning in 2003, I wrote a chapter entitled Effective Investigation, Civil Liberties and Effective Investigation. The point is, you do not trade the adherence to the law and to the Constitution, civil liberties, which is, you know, that's not even the right term. We're talking about following the law. And what they're suggesting is you trade the law for security, a false security, this idea that we're safe, which these latest videos on beheading kind of prove wrong. But, you know, that is wrong. And I wrote a big article about this in 2003. It's published in Patriotism, Democracy, and Common Sense, Restoring America's Promise at Home and Abroad. In 2007, I wrote an article, How Not to Counter Terrorism. You can Google that title, How Not to Counter Terrorism. And then I wrote a later one just about 3 years ago, and I'm trying to remember the title of this last one I wrote, but it's in a book entitled Why Peace? It's a book of chapters of all different people from all different avenues explaining why peace. I mean, you wouldn't think you'd have to write a book to explain why peace is better than war, would you? But in an Orwellian situation, you do. And you need people with credibility. So the people that are, it's a really good book. I haven't even gotten through it all myself. But Mark Gutman, who is a doctor, is the editor for this. And he got a whole range of people to write Why Peace. Well, I wrote on the domestic law enforcement again and how this is all being turned on us. And you know, this is very important because I think when American citizens realize that the war is not simply on Afghans, Pakistanis, Yemen, you know, other people, if they realize it's actually they are in the crosshairs as well, in different ways, that then there is a chance that we can stop it. Because people have to realize it's not just others. Anyways, I have written chapters in book, but not an entire book.
In regards to 9/11, are you familiar with an intelligence unit known as Able Danger, who supposedly predicted the attacks, but their recommendations were supposedly ignored or buried due to political purposes?
Yes, I sure am. The colonel who wrote that book, do you remember his name now? He's actually my Facebook friend, and I've met him a few times. I can't remember his name. I've got a block right now. But he wrote this book, and he was in the program, Able Danger. And, yes, it appears that through different ways of kind of profiling, whatever, and also because they did not have the flood of data that's been flooded since that time, that they actually did pop out Mohammed Atta and other hijackers' names. Now, he told this to the 9/11 Commission, but the 9/11 Commission did not publish anything. They told him originally Zelikow. I think he even talked to Zelikow, who wrote the 9/11 Commission report. And they were all interested in finding out that there were programs that had actually even come up with the names of the hijackers. They were originally very interested, but when the report comes out, it's missing. Just as to this day, there are 28 pages redacted from the Joint Intelligence Committee's report, believed to be alleging that or saying that Saudi Arabia, certain Saudis, funded a lot of the terrorism. And, of course, that was blacked out, redacted out, because that's going to hurt our ally. And, of course, to this day, when you have a lack of truth that goes all the way back, how are you able to fix it? If you don't know that this was... Now, I think the CIA, on the day of 9/11, had something like 18 people listed on their terrorism watch list. It's something like that. They had a few, but they were right about the few they had listed. They had some of... I think they even had some of the hijackers on that list. Okay, now there are hundreds of thousands of names on that. So they went from being able to... Again, this is this whole point about the haystack. And it doesn't help anybody to be stopping the little old grandmother and the fracker, anti-frackers, etc. It actually helps to have quality over quantity. And it's a hard concept for people to understand, but if you're in the intelligence business, collect it all makes no sense. So I do know him. He couldn't publish his book. They didn't allow him to publish his book, and they actually tried to rip it off the shelves. The Pentagon and whatever. He had gotten it authorized, by the way, pre-publication review. And then they said, no, we have something in there that we have to, and they ripped it off. And he sold more books afterwards because it created a controversy. So I think, I don't know. I have no way of knowing myself about the truth of any of this. But I think, well, from what I know, it seems like it's probably accurate, that book, Able Danger Program.
Thank you very much, Colleen.
You've been listening to former FBI Special Agent Colleen Rowley talking about 9/11 and whistleblowing and the risks thereof. Hope you enjoyed this broadcast. It was originally recorded on September 14th of 2014 at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. This program is produced and edited each week by Barry Lee. Thank you to the staff at All Souls for their help in recording this program, and especially Rita Norton, who coordinates this program on the All Souls side of the fence. Tune in again next week, same time, same station, for another edition of the All Souls Forum. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.